as if he'd been there before, a long time ago, or maybe dreamed it. By the edge of the forest on the other side he could see light shining from a house with a large terrace. Leah reached it eventually and rang the bell. A young couple lived there. Their names are Stina and Henrik Norbring, in case you want to check. They were getting ready for Christmas, wrapping presents for their children. They were terrified at first. Leo must have looked like an absolute wreck, but he reassured them, saying that his car had skidded off the road. He'd lost his phone and probably had a concussion. I suppose it must have sounded convincing. The couple took him inside and ran him a hot bath. They gave him dry clothes and fed him Jansson's Temptation and Christmas ham, a little mulled wine and schnapps, and slowly he began to revive. But he had no idea what he should do next. He was desperate to contact me, but he knew that Raquel Greitz had taken my mobile and was afraid that my emails were also being monitored. Leo's smart, though. He's usually one step ahead of the rest of us. He thought it would be safe to send a coded message that looked innocuous, something I might easily be getting the day before Christmas. He borrowed a mobile from the Norbrings and sent me a text. "Congrats, Daniel. Evita Kohn wants to tour with you in U.S. in Feb. Please confirm. Django. Will be a minor swing. Merry Christmas."
"Okay," Blomqvist said. "I think I'm beginning to understand. But what did the message mean?"
"Well, he didn't want to give away my American name. He chose an artist he knew I never played with, so nobody would be able to trace me that way. But above all, he signed off as Django." "Right. That in itself would have been enough for the penny to drop, but on top of that, will be a minor swing."
Dan paused for a moment.
"Minor swing is a piece with incredible joie de vivre. Maybe that's not quite right. There's a dark streak, too. Django and Stefan Grappelli wrote it together. Leo and I must have played it 4 or 5 times already. We loved it. But..."
Blomqvist waited for him to go on.
"After Leo sent the message, his condition deteriorated. Apparently he collapsed, and the couple had him lie down on their sofa. He had difficulty breathing, and his lips turned blue. I was unaware of all this. I was in Leo's apartment, and it had gotten late. The three of us were there, Benjamin, Raquel, and me. I was downing glass after glass of wine while Raquel went through the whole repulsive plan she had cooked up. Shocked as I was, I played along. I agreed to become Leo, to do exactly as she said. She told me how to order new credit cards and get new passwords, and to go and see Vivica at her hospice, Stockholm Sjukhem, as Leo. She said I had to take a sabbatical and travel and read up on the financial markets and lose my American and my northern Swedish accents. Raquel flew around the apartment and dug up Leo's passport and some papers so that I could practice his signature. It was unbearable. And those threats were always there, the threat that as Daniel I could be convicted for the murder of my brother, or that as Leo I could go to prison for insider trading and tax fraud. I sat there mesmerized, just looking at her. Or rather, I tried to look at her, but mostly I averted my eyes or closed them and saw in my mind's eye Leo staggering off into the forest, disappearing in the darkness and cold. I didn't see how he could possibly have survived. I pictured him lying in the snow, freezing to death. I couldn't imagine that Raquel really believed in her plan either. She must have seen that I'd never be able to pull it off, that I would go to pieces at the slightest suspicion. I remember how she exchanged looks with Benjamin and issued him instructions from time to time. All the while she was fussing with something, arranging pens, wiping tabletops and chairs, looking in drawers, straightening things. At one point she took my phone out of her pocket and saw Leo's text. She started grilling me about my friends, my business contacts, and fellow musicians, and I answered as best I could, some of it true, maybe, but mostly half-truths and lies. I don't really know. I could hardly speak, and yet, you know, to save money, I'd gotten myself a Swedish SIM card and hadn't given the number to many people, so the text made me curious. "What was that message?" I asked, as casually as I could. Raquel showed it to me, and seeing those words, I felt like I'd gotten my life back. But I must have controlled myself well. I don't think she noticed anything. "That's a gig, right?" she said. I nodded. She told me I had to turn down those things from now on. She took back my phone and issued even more dire warnings. But I was no longer listening. I went along with everything. I think I even managed to sound a little greedy. "How much money am I actually going to get?" I wanted to know. She gave me a very precise answer, which I later realized was an exaggeration, as if my decision might depend on a couple of million one way or the other. By then it was already 11:30 at night. We'd been at it for hours. I was dead tired, and also pretty drunk. "Can we stop now?" I said. "I have to get some sleep.
and I remember Ratgirl hesitated. Was it safe to leave me on my own? Eventually she must have decided she had to trust me. I was so terrified she would change her mind that I didn't dare ask for my phone back. I just stood there rooted to the spot, nodding at her threats and promises. But they left. They left, and I concentrated on one thing only, remembering the number Leo's text had been sent from. I remembered only the last 5 digits. I rummaged around in drawers and coat pockets until I found Leo's private mobile, which, typical for him, needed no security code. I tried every conceivable prefix to those 5 numbers. I woke up quite a few people and dialed some non-existent lines, but none of them was right. I swore and cried, and I was sure that Rackle would soon get another text from him, which would be a disaster. Then I remembered the sign we passed just before the car stopped in the forest. Vidocre, it said. I guessed Leo must have found help somewhere nearby, and so...
You checked Vidocre, and the 5 digits you'd remembered.
Exactly. And I found Henrik Norbring immediately. His phone number came up with all sorts of information, including how old he was. There was even a picture of his house and an estimate of its value compared to other properties in the area. Isn't the internet incredible? I remember that I hesitated, that my hands were shaking.
But you called, didn't you?
I did. Do you mind if we take a break?
Blomqvist nodded, his face grim, and he put a hand on Dan's shoulder. Then he went into the galley kitchen, switched on his mobile, and washed up the glasses while he waited. In almost no time, the phone began to beep and buzz, and he looked at his messages to see what was going on. There was one from Bublansky.
"Call me. Salander in danger."
He swore and rushed back into the studio.
"Whatever may have happened, Dan, I hope you appreciate that we have to make this public as quickly as possible. Not least for your sake," he said. "I'm sorry we don't have time to go through the rest now, but I have to rush off. Given the circumstances, it's important that you stay here in the studio. I'll arrange for my colleague, my boss, in fact, Erica Berrier, to come and keep you company. Would that be okay? She's a good and reliable person. You'll like her. I have to go now."
Dan nodded, and for a moment looked so confused and helpless that Blomqvist gave him a quick, rough hug. He handed over the keys to the studio and thanked him.
"It was brave of you to tell me. I'll look forward to hearing the rest."
As he raced down the stairs, he called Erica on an encrypted line. She agreed to drive over right away, just as he had expected. Next, he made several attempts to get hold of Salander. No response. So he tried Bublansky.
Chapter 23 June 22nd. Bublansky had every reason to be satisfied. He had arrested Bashir and his brother Razan Kazi, plus the notorious Benito Anderson and a member of the Slavelshire MC gang. Instead, he was upset and disappointed. Officers from both the Uppsala and Stockholm police forces had been searching the woods around Vadaborshu, but they had found no trace of Salander apart from bloodstains in the van and signs of a break-in at a holiday home further up the hill where they had come across bloody footprints from child-sized sneakers. What on earth was she thinking? Salander obviously needed medical attention. There were ambulances heading their way, but she had chosen to plunge into the forest a couple of miles off any main road. Maybe she just ran for her life, with no time to realize that help was at hand. But if a vital organ had been perforated by Benito's dagger, Salander would be in trouble, maybe even dying. Why was she not like other people?
Bublansky had reached police headquarters on Bjergskartan, and was just walking into his office when his mobile rang. It was Blomqvist, at last, and the chief inspector gave him a broad-brush account of what had been happening. It was clear that his words hit home. Blomqvist asked a whole string of questions, and only then did he say that he was beginning to understand why Holger Palmgren had been murdered. He promised to come back to Bublansky with more as soon as he could, but right now he had no time to talk. Bublansky sighed and had no option but to acquiesce.
December, 1.5 years earlier. It was 10 past midnight. Christmas Eve, finally. Heavy wet snow lay on the window ledge, and the sky was a canvas of black and grey. The city lay silent, save for the occasional car on Karlavegen. Dan stood at the window, shaking all over, and dialed the number for Henrik Norbring in Vidokra. The ringtone echoed in his ear. No answer. Then he heard a recorded message that ended with a repetitive, "Hope you're good, hope you're well." Dan looked around the apartment in desperation. There was no sign of the drama that had only recently taken place there, but instead an unfamiliar clinical tidiness prevailed, plus a smell of disinfectant. He escaped into the guest room where he had been sleeping for the past week and tried the number again and again. He cursed. He was beside himself. He could see that Greitz had been at it in here as well. What on earth had she been up to? She seemed to have cleaned and wiped down Everest's surface. He had the urge to create chaos and disorder, rip the sheets off the bed, throw books at the wall, anything to rid himself of every trace of her. Instead, he looked out the window and heard music playing from a radio on the floor below. Perhaps a minute or two passed before he picked up Leo's mobile again. Just then it rang in his hand. He answered eagerly. On the other end was the very same voice from the voicemail greeting, but now it no longer sounded so chirpy. It was serious and composed, as if something terrible had happened. "Is Leo there?" Dan gasped. For a while there was no answer, just a silence which seemed to confirm the worst, and which also brought back the terrifying reality of the forest. He remembered the chill of Leo's lips, the absence of any light in his eyes, the lack of response from his lungs. "Is he there? Is he alive?" "Wait," the voice said. There was a crackling in the receiver. He could hear footsteps. It took time, so much time. Then suddenly life returned, and with it, the world and its colours. "Dan?" said a voice, which could have been his own. "Leo," he whispered. "You're alive. I'm okay. The cramps came back, but Stina here, she's a nurse. She sorted me out." He told Dan he was lying on a sofa with two blankets over him. His voice sounded weak, yet steady, and he was clearly unsure as to what he could say in front of whoever was there with him, but he did mention Django and Minor Swing. "You saved my life," Leo said. "I think I did. That's pretty major." "You mean it was Swing?" "It doesn't get more swing than that, brother." Dan did not answer. "Contramundum," Leo said. "What's that?" Dan said. "The two of us against the world, my friend. You and me." They decided to meet mid-morning at Hotel Amaranten on Kungsholmsgården, not far from Rådhuset, where Leo was certain they would not bump into anyone he knew. Dan sent a taxi to bring him into the city, and the brothers spent those hours on Christmas Eve in a room on the fourth floor, talking and making plans with the curtains drawn. They renewed their alliance and their pact, and just before the shops closed for the holidays at 2 p.m, Dan bought two mobiles with prepaid SIM cards, so that they would be able to communicate. He headed to Floregatan, and when Greitz rang on the landline, he repeated in grave tones that he had decided to do as she suggested. He spoke to a nurse at Stockholm's sjukhem, who said that his mother was under sedation and would not live long. He wished all of them on the ward a happy Christmas and asked them to kiss Vivica on the forehead for him. He said he would visit soon. That afternoon he returned to the Amaranten and told Leo as much as he could about the file Greitz said she had compiled on insider trading deals and tax fraud carried out in his name. There was depthless rage in his brother's eyes, a terrifying hatred, and Dan listened in silence as Leo went on about how they would take revenge on Ivar and Raquel and all the rest of them. He put a hand on Leo's shoulder to share his pain, but his own thoughts were less about revenge and more about Greitz's insistence on the mighty powers that stood behind her. He also remembered the car journey in the dark, and the grave in the forest by the old pine tree. His whole body told him that he did not have the courage to retaliate, not right away. Perhaps, it occurred to him later, this had something to do with his background. Unlike Leo, he did not have the confidence to believe he could win against the establishment. Or perhaps it was simply that he had his eyes opened to the ruthlessness with which this group operated. "Absolutely, we'll crush them," Dan said. "But this has to be planned meticulously, don't you think? We need evidence. We have to prepare the ground. Why don't we look at it as an opportunity to start afresh, try something new?" He didn't know what he was trying to say. He was just floating an idea. But gradually it took hold, and an hour later, after much discussion, they were forging plans,
tentatively at first, then more and more seriously. They knew they would have to act quickly before Greitz and her organization, whatever it was, would see that they had been duped. On Christmas Day, Leo made the first of what would be many transfers to Dan Brody's bank account. Then he bought a ticket to Boston for the following day in Dan's name. But it was Leo who made the journey, with Dan's American passport and papers. Dan stayed in Leo's apartment, where Greitz came to see him on the evening of December 26th to draw up guidelines for his new life. He played the part well, and if at times he did not look as disconsolate as he should have, Greitz seemed to interpret that as a sign that he was enjoying his new existence already. "You see your own evil in others," as Leo said later on the telephone. On December 28th, Dan was sitting at Leo's mother's bedside at Stockholm's Sjukhem. He did not say much, and none of the staff appeared to suspect anything, which boosted his confidence. He tried to look upset, yet composed, and sometimes he was genuinely moved, even though he was with a person he had never met before. Vivica was emaciated and pale, bird-like. She was sleeping with her mouth open, and her breathing was weak. Someone had combed her hair and applied a little makeup, and she had been propped up on two pillows. At one point, he felt it would be expected, he stroked her shoulder and arm. She opened her eyes and looked at him critically, which made him feel uncomfortable but not worried. She was heavily sedated with morphine, so it was probably safe to assume that nothing she could say would be taken seriously.
"Who are you?" she said.
Something harsh and judgmental surfaced in her delicate, pointed features.
"It's me, Mama. Leo."
She appeared to be reflecting on this. She swallowed and gathered some strength.
"You never turned out as we had hoped, Leo," she said. "You were a disappointment to Papa and me."
Dan closed his eyes and remembered everything Leo had told him about his mother. It was astonishingly easy to reply, maybe precisely because the woman was a stranger.
"You were never what I'd hoped for, either. You never understood me. It was you who let me down."
She looked at him, surprised and confused.
"You let Leo down," he said. "You let us both down. All of you did."
He walked out and went back home through the city. The following day, December 29th, Vivica Mannheimer died. The director of Stockholm's Sjukhem telephoned to let him know, and Dan put the announcements and the funeral arrangements into the hands of an undertaker recommended by the hospice. They could organize it however they thought best, he told them, a week or so into the new year. He himself would not be attending. When he told Ivar Ögren that he needed a long sabbatical, he got in return only coarse language and foul comments about how irresponsible he was. He did not bother to answer. On January 4th, he too left the country, with Greitz's approval. He flew to New York and met his brother in Washington, D.C. They stayed together for a week before going their separate ways. Leo, as Dan, cautiously got to know the musicians on the Boston jazz scene. He explained he had started playing piano, but was nervous about performing in public. His Swedish accent worried him, and he was homesick until he decided to move to Toronto, where he met Marie Denver. She was a young interior designer with dreams of becoming an artist, and she was considering setting up a business together with her sister. She was not sure if she dared to take the plunge. Leo invested some capital and took a seat on the board. Not long after, the couple bought a house in Hogs Hollow. He played the piano regularly with a small group of talented amateur musicians, all of whom were doctors. Dan was rootless for a long time. He travelled around Europe and Asia, playing guitar and reading up on the financial markets. He found he had a burning thirst for knowledge. He felt, or rather believed, that as an outsider he would be able to apply a new kind of meta-perspective to the financial markets, and in the end he decided to resume Leo's place at Alfred Ögren, not least to find out about the dossier of evidence Raquel Greitz and Ivar Ögren had against his brother. He realized that it would not be easy to deny the allegations. When he instructed one of Stockholm's best business lawyers, Bengt Wallin, to look into them, and was briefed on the extent and type of deals carried out in Leo's name through Mossack Fonseca in Panama, he was strongly advised to leave it alone. As the weeks went by, life resumed its normal course, as it tends to do. Dan and Leo bided their time and remained in close contact. When Dan left Blomqvist in the lobby of Alfred Ogren that day, the person he called was Leo. Leo was silent for a long while and then told Dan it was up to him to decide if the time was right to tell their story, adding that it would be hard to find a more suitable outlet than Mikael Blomqvist at Millennium. Now Dan had indeed started to talk, though he hadn't yet said anything about Leo's new life in Canada. Standing at the window of the studio, he called Toronto once again and was deep in conversation when he was interrupted by a discreet knock at the door. Erika Berger had arrived. Earlier that day, feeling horribly nauseous, Greitz had dragged herself back along to Hamnegården, meaning to take a taxi to go home to Karlbergsvägen and collapse in her bed. But halfway there she became angry with herself and went to her office in the west of the city instead. It was unlike her to let illness or adversity get the upper hand. She decided to keep fighting and activated every contact and ally she could think of to find Blomqvist and Daniel Brolin, all except Steinberg, who had broken down after repeated calls from the police. She sent Benjamin off to the Millennium offices on Jutgarten and to Blomqvist's apartment building on Bellmansgarten. But Benjamin only encountered locked doors. In the end, she gave up for the day and let him drive her home. She needed to get some rest, and also to destroy the most sensitive of Project Nine's documents, which she kept at home in a safe behind the wardrobe in her bedroom. It was 4:30 p.m. and still unbearably hot. She let Benjamin help her out of the car. She really did need him, and not only as a bodyguard. She was groggy after all the stress of the day. Her black turtleneck was damp with sweat. The city swayed before her eyes. She stood straight and looked up at the sky, and for a moment her look was triumphant. She might ultimately be unmasked and humiliated, but she had fought, she was convinced of this, for something greater than herself, for science and for the future. She was determined to go down with dignity. She vowed to remain strong and proud to the end, however ill she might be. At the building's street entrance, she asked Benjamin to hand her the orange juice he had bought for her on the way, and, even though it was a little undignified, she drank straight from the bottle and felt briefly restored. They took the lift to the 6th floor, where she unlocked the front door and asked Benjamin to go in ahead and switch off the burglar alarm. She was just about to step over the threshold when she froze and looked down towards the floor below. A pale figure was climbing the stairs. A young woman who seemed to have risen from the underworld. Salander was more presentable than she had been, even if her face was white and eyes bloodshot, her cheeks scratched from brambles and bushes. She was walking with visible difficulty, but she had gone to the trouble of buying a T-shirt and a pair of jeans from a second-hand shop on Upplandsgarten, and had stuffed her blood-stained clothes into a bin. She had also bought a mobile in a Telenor store, and dressings and disinfectant at a pharmacy. Standing on the pavement, she ripped off the duct tape she had found in a holiday home in the woods, and used to staunch the flow of blood from her hip, and she replaced it with a new and better bandage. For a while she had been lying semi-conscious on the forest floor. As soon as she came to, she sawed through the rope around her wrists on a jagged rock. She made her way to National Highway 77, and got a lift from a woman in an old Rover all the way to Vasastan, where she attracted a good deal of attention. According to a witness named Kjell Ove Strömgren, she looked unwell and dangerous when she walked in through said doorway at Karlbergsvägen. She didn't bother to look at herself in the mirror in the entrance hall, as she did not expect it would be edifying. She felt like shit. The dagger had probably not damaged any vital organs, but she had lost a significant amount of blood, and was ready to pass out. Greitz, or Nordin, as the misleading sign on the door said, was not at home. Salander sat on the landing one level down, and from there she texted Blomqvist. He sent back a lot of sensible advice and other crap. All she wanted to know, she texted back, was what he had found out. Finally, he gave her a summary, and she nodded as she read it and closed her eyes. The pain and the dizziness were getting worse, and she only just managed to resist the impulse to stretch out on the floor. For a moment it felt as if she would never be able to pull herself together again, or to do anything at all, but then she thought of Palmgren. She remembered how he had come all the way to Floridberg in his wheelchair, and she couldn't help thinking how much she had meant to her all these years. But above all she thought about what Blomqvist had told her of his death, and it was clear that he was right. Only Greitz could have killed the old man. She drew strength from that. It was up to her to avenge Palmgren. She knew she had to strike with all her might, however weak she felt. So she pulled back her shoulders and shook her head, and finally, after another 10 or 15 minutes, the rickety lift stopped on the floor above her. The door was pushed open, and through the banisters she could make out a large man and a much older woman in a black turtleneck. Oddly enough, Salander recognized her by the way she carried herself. It was as if the mere sight of Greitz's ramrod spine had taken her back to her childhood. But she did not allow herself to dwell on it. She sent a rapid message to Bublansky and Mordig and headed up the stairs, not very steadily and apparently not very quietly either. Greitz spun around and looked Salander in the eye, first in surprise, and then, once she had recognized her, with fear and loathing. Salander stopped on the stairs, holding the wound in her side.
"We meet again," Salander said.
"You took your time.
And yet it seems like yesterday, don't you think?"
Greitz ignored the question and growled,
"Benjamin, bring her here."
Benjamin nodded. He was a foot and a half taller than Salander and twice as broad, so he didn't seem to think he would have any trouble. But when he lunged at her, he was carried forward not only by the sheer mass of his body, but also by the downward slope of the steps. Salander stepped neatly to one side, took hold of the man's left arm, and tugged. At that moment, Benjamin's determination proved counterproductive. He went down head first on the stone landing, cracking his elbow on the way. Salander saw none of it. She was already hobbling up the stairs, shoving Greitz inside and locking the door behind them. Benjamin was soon hammering on the outside of the door. Greitz backed away, clutching her brown leather bag. In a few seconds she had regained the upper hand, but that had nothing to do with the bag or its contents. Salander had expended so much energy on the stairs that her dizziness almost overwhelmed her. She looked around the apartment through half-closed eyes, and although her vision was hardly clear, she knew she had never seen anything like it. Not only was the place devoid of all colour, everything was either black or white, it was also dazzlingly clean and clinical, as if an android lived there rather than a human being. There could not have been a speck of dust in the entire apartment. Salander steadied herself against the black chest of drawers. Just as she was about to pass out, she saw from the corner of her eye Greitz advancing towards her, holding something in her hand. A syringe.
"I've just been hearing how you like to stick needles into people," Salander said.
Greitz attacked, but to no avail. Salander kicked the syringe out of her hand, and it fell onto the shiny white floor and rolled away. Even though her head was spinning, she managed to stay on her feet, and for a few seconds she focused only on Greitz. She was surprised at how calm the woman looked.
"Go ahead and kill me. I'll die with pride," Greitz said.
"With pride, did you say?"
"Absolutely."
"Not going to happen."
Salander looked sick and spoke in a flat, exhausted voice, but still Greitz knew that this was the end of the road. She looked towards the window on her left, out towards Karl Berisvegen, and hesitated for a second or two. Then it became clear that she had no alternative. Anything would be better than ending up in Salander's clutches, so she made a dash for the balcony door and felt a terrifying pull of the urge to jump. But Salander caught her before she could climb over the railing. It wasn't exactly what either of them had expected. Raquel Greitz was being saved by the person she had dreaded more than anyone else. Salander held her firmly and led her back into her clinically clean apartment.
"You will die, Raquel. Don't you worry about that," she whispered in her ear.
"I know," she said. "I've got cancer."
"The cancer's nothing." Salander's tone was chilling.
"What do you mean?"
Salander stared at the ground.
"Holger meant a lot to me," she said.
And she gripped Greitz's hand so hard it felt to Greitz as if her blood had frozen.
"What I'm saying is that the cancer will seem like nothing, Raquel. You're going to die of shame, too. And believe me, that'll be the worst part. I'll make sure so much dirt is unearthed about you that no one will remember you for anything other than all the evil you have unleashed. You'll be buried in your own excrement."
She said this with such conviction that Greitz believed it. Then Salander calmly opened the door to let in a group of policemen, who had handcuffed Benjamin to a banister.
"Good afternoon, Fru Greitz. You and I have a lot to talk about. We've just arrested your colleague, Professor Steinberg,"
said a dark-haired man with a half-smile, who introduced himself as Chief Inspector Bublansky. It did not take his men long to find the safe behind her wardrobe. The last she saw of Salander was her back as paramedics led her away. Salander didn't turn around once. It was as if Greitz no longer existed for her. Chapter 24 June 30th. It was another hot summer's day. There had not been a drop of rain for 2 weeks. Blomqvist was in the kitchen area at Millennium's editorial offices on Jutgarten. He had just finished writing his long piece on the registry and Project 9. He stretched his back and drank some water and looked over towards the bright blue sofa on the other side of the room. Erika Berrier lay stretched out in her high-heeled shoes, reading his article. He was not exactly nervous. He knew for sure it made for harrowing reading. They had a scoop which would be tremendous for the magazine, yet he still did not know how Berrier would react, not because of the one or two sections which gave rise to ethical questions, but because of their argument. He had told her that he would not be spending the midsummer weekend out in the archipelago or celebrating in any way. Instead, he would be concentrating on his story. He needed to go through the documents he had received from Bublansky, and he needed to interview Hilda von Kantervoort again, as well as Dan Brody and Leo Mannheimer, who had come to Stockholm from Toronto in secret with his fiancée. And Blomqvist had been working pretty much around the clock, not just on the report about the registry, but also on the Faria Kazi story. It was not he who had actually written it. Sophie Melker had, but he was involved from start to finish and had discussed the legal process with his sister while she worked to get Faria released and protected with a new identity. He was regularly in touch with Inspector Mordig, who was leading the newly reopened inquiry into what was now accepted as the murder of Jamal Chowdhury, for which Bashir, Razan and Khalil Kazi and two others were in custody and awaiting trial. Benito Anderson had been taken to Hammerfors prison in Hernosand, and she too was awaiting fresh charges. Plus, Blomqvist often got caught up in long conversations with Bublansky, and he was spending more time on the purely stylistic side of the story too. But even he had gotten to the point where he could do no more. He needed a break. He was almost seeing double, and it was unbearably hot at his desk on Bellmansgarten. One afternoon he felt a pang of longing and called Marlin Frode.
"Would you come over?" he said. "Pretty please."
Marlin agreed to get a babysitter if Blomqvist promised to buy strawberries and champagne and turn back his sheets, and not have his mind on other things like Calais-fucking Blomqvist usually did. He told her the conditions sounded reasonable enough, and so they were tumbling about in bed, happy and drunk and oblivious to the rest of the world, when Berrier dropped by unannounced with an expensive bottle of red wine. Berrier had never considered Blomqvist a model of good behaviour, and she herself was married and not overly scrupulous about dalliances, yet it had all gotten out of hand. If he had had the time and inclination, he could have worked out why. One reason was Marlin's fiery temperament, and another was the fact that Berrier was upset and embarrassed. They had all been embarrassed. The women began to argue with each other, and then they argued with him, too, until Berrier marched off in a fury, slamming the door behind her. Since then, conversations at the magazine between her and Blomqvist had been strained and confined to work issues. But now Berrier was lying there reading, and Blomqvist was thinking about Salander. She had been discharged from the hospital and had flown in haste to Gibraltar. She said she had business to attend to there, but they had kept in touch every day about Faria Kazi and about the investigation into the registry. So far, the public knew nothing about the background to the story, and the names of the presumed suspects had not yet been published in any major media. Berrier had therefore been insistent that they swiftly put out a special issue of the magazine so that no one could scoop them.
Perhaps that was why she was so upset when she found Blomkvist lying in bed, drinking champagne, though he could not have been more serious about getting the report ready. Now he kept sneaking looks at Beria, who eventually took off her reading glasses and got up and joined him in the kitchen. She was wearing jeans and a blue blouse open at the neck. She sat next to him at the table. He couldn't guess whether she would begin with praise or with criticism.
"I don't understand it."
"That's unfortunate," he said. "I was hoping I had shed at least some light on the story."
"Why on earth did they keep it a secret for so long?"
"Leo and Dan? As I say in the article, there was evidence that Leo had been involved in illegal transactions through various dummy companies. Although it's clear now that Ivar Ögren and Rakel Greitz had set him up, Leo and Dan couldn't find any way of getting at them. Besides, and I hope this is clear from what I've written, they were beginning to enjoy their new roles. Neither of them was short of money. Large sums were being transferred all the time, and I think both of them were experiencing a new kind of freedom. A bit like the freedom that any actor enjoys. They could start afresh and do something different. I can understand the appeal."
"And then they fell in love?"
"With Julia and Marie."
"The pictures are wonderful."
"That's something, at least."
"It's good that we've got decent photographers," she said. "But you do realize that Ivar Ögren's going to sue the crap out of us?"
"I think we're well armed for that, Erika.
Plus, I'm worried about defaming the dead, because of that fatal incident at the elk hunt."
"I'm sure I'm on firm ground there, too. All I'm actually saying is that the circumstances surrounding the shooting are unclear."
"I'm not sure it's good enough. Just that is already pretty damaging."
"Okay, I'll take another look. Is there anything that doesn't worry you, or that you even, dare I say it, do understand?"
"You're a bastard."
"Maybe a bit. Especially after dark."
"Are you planning to devote yourself to one woman only from now on, or are you considering spending time with others too?"
"In a pinch, I could imagine drinking champagne with you. If worst came to worst."
"You won't have any choice."
"Will you force me?"
"If I have to, yes. Because this article, the part we're not going to be sued for, that is, it's..." She held back.
"Broadly acceptable," he said.
"You could say that," she replied, and smiled. "Congratulations."
She opened her arms to embrace him. But then something else grabbed their attention, and later it would prove difficult to recall the exact sequence of events. Sophie Melka was probably the first to react. She was at her computer in the editorial offices and yelled out something incomprehensible, but it was clear that she was either shocked or surprised. Soon afterwards, or at the same time, Beria and Blomkvist received news flashes on their mobiles. Neither of them was especially worried. It was not a terrorist attack or a threat of war. It was only a stock market crash. But gradually they were consumed by the events as they unfolded. Step by step, they entered into the state of heightened awareness which one finds in every press room when major, world-shattering news events occur. They became wholly concentrated and shouted out what they saw on their computers. There were new developments every minute. The crash accelerated. The floor was pulled out from under the market. The Stockholm index was down by 6%, then 8%, and fell further to minus 9% and 14%. At that stage it showed signs of a small recovery, then continued to fall again, as if plummeting into a black hole. It was a full-blown crash, a galloping panic, and so far nobody seemed to understand what was happening. There was nothing specific, no apparent trigger. People muttered, "Incomprehensible! It's madness! What's going on?" Soon after, when the experts were called in, all the usual explanations were trotted out. An overheated economy, low interest rates, the overvalued market, political threats from both West and East, instability in the Middle East and fascist and anti-democratic movements in Europe and the US, a political witch's cauldron reminiscent of the 1930s. But nothing new had happened that day. No development significant enough to have precipitated a disaster on this scale. The panic appeared out of nowhere, and was self-sustaining. Blomkvist was not the only one reminded of the hacker attack on finance security in April. He went onto social media, and was not surprised to find rumours and allegations raging, all too often gaining a foothold in the mainstream media. Blomqvist said aloud, though it sounded more as if he were talking to himself. "It's not just the stock exchange that is crashing."
"What do you mean?" Beria said.
"Truth is going the same way." It was as if the internet trolls had taken over to create a fake dynamic in which lies and truth were set against each other as if they were equivalent notions, an impenetrable fog of fabrications and conspiracy theories settled over the world. Sometimes the trolls did a good job, sometimes not. For example, it was reported that financier Christer Tallgren had shot himself in his apartment in Paris, devastated by the fact that his millions, or was it billions, had gone up in smoke. Tallgren's own denial of the story on Twitter was not the only noteworthy thing about it. There was also the fact that it echoed Ivar Kreuger's death by his own hand in 1932. A mixture of urban myths and apocryphal stories, both new and old, swirled in the air. There was talk of automated trading having run amok, about financial centres and media houses and websites having been hacked, but there were also reports that people were about to jump to their deaths from balconies and roofs in Östermalm, which not only sounded wildly melodramatic, but also harked back to the 1929 stock exchange crash, when roofers working on Wall Street buildings were said to have been mistaken for ill-fated investors, and had contributed to the tumbling market merely by being up there. It was claimed that Handelsbanken had stopped its payments, and that Deutsche Bank and Goldman Sachs were on the verge of bankruptcy. News came pouring in from every direction, and not even a well-trained eye like Blomqvist's could tell the difference between what was true and what was fabricated by the organized groups of trolls in the East. He had no doubt, however, that Stockholm was the hardest hit. The stock market crash was not as bad in Frankfurt, London, or Paris, although there was rising panic in those cities too. The American exchanges would not be opening for several hours. Even so, futures prices suggested that there would be sharp downturns on the Dow Jones and Nasdaq. Nothing seemed to help, least of all when central bank governors and ministers, economists and gurus, stepped up to talk about overreaction, saying that nobody should rock the boat. Everything was cast in a negative light and distorted. The herd was already in motion and running for its life, although nobody knew who or what had frightened it. A decision was made to suspend trading on the Stockholm Stock Exchange, perhaps too hastily because prices had begun to recover only moments before, but investigations and analyses were needed before there could be a resumption of trading.
"Too bad about your twins' story. It'll drown in this mess."
Blomqvist looked up from his computer and gazed wistfully at Beria.
"I'm touched that you're concerned about my professional pride, when the whole world has gone mad," he said.
"I'm thinking of Millennium."
"I understand. But we have to delay publication now, don't you think? We can't put out a new issue without addressing this, too."
"No new print issue, I agree with that. But we have to at least publish something of this finished piece online. Otherwise someone could get out ahead of us."
"Okay," he said. "You're probably right. Whatever you think best.
But then you'll have to get going again on this latest story. Can you bear to?"
"Of course, no problem."
"Good," she said.
And they nodded at each other. It would be a hot and oppressive summer, and Blomqvist decided to take a walk before tackling the next story. He came down Jutgatan towards Slussen, thinking of Holger Palmgren and his clenched fist, in the bed in Liljeholmen.
Epilogue. The cathedral was packed. It was not just that it was Storkirchen, and it was not as if the funeral was for some famous statesman. It was for an elderly lawyer who had never taken on any high-profile cases, but had rather spent his whole working life fighting on behalf of young people who had gone astray. Millennium's recently published report into the so-called twins scandal may have had something to do with it, though, along with the publicity around the old man's murder. It was 2 p.m. The funeral service had been dignified and moving, with a somewhat unconventional sermon which had scarcely referred to the Almighty or to Jesus, but portrayed the dead man with fine brushstrokes. It had been overshadowed, however, by the emotional eulogy delivered by Holger Palmgren's half-sister, Britt Marie Norén. Many of those sitting in the pews were deeply moved, especially a tall, stately African woman by the name of Lulu Magoro, who was weeping uncontrollably.
Many others had tears in their eyes or their heads lowered respectfully. Relatives, friends, former colleagues, neighbours, a number of clients who looked to have done well for themselves. Mikhail Blomqvist was there, as was his sister, Annika Giannini, Chief Inspector Bublansky and his fiancée, Farah Sharif, and inspectors Sonia Morig and Jerka Holmberry, as well as Erika Beria and many others who had been close to Holger. But there were also those who had come out of curiosity and were looking around excitedly, which did not appear to please the priest, a tall, slim woman in her 60s with snow-white hair and sharp features. She stepped forward again with her air of natural authority and nodded at a man in a black linen jacket who was sitting in the second row on the left. The man, Dragan Armansky, the owner of the company Milton Security, shook his head. It was his turn to speak, but he no longer wanted to. It was not obvious why. The priest accepted his apology and prepared for the mourners to file past the coffin, giving a signal to the musicians above. At that moment, a young woman stood up at the back of the church and called out, "Stop! Wait!" It took a while before people realized it was Lisbeth Salander. That may have been because she was wearing a black, tailored suit, which made her look like a young boy, although she had still managed to forget to do something about her hair. It was as messy and spiky as ever. She made no effort to approach the coffin in a way appropriate to the occasion, either. There was something aggressive about the way she moved, and yet, in a curious paradox, she appeared oddly indecisive. When she reached the altar, she stared at the floor, refusing to meet the eye of anyone in the congregation. For a moment, it looked as though she might go and sit down again.
"Would you like to say a few words?" the priest said.
She nodded.
"Please, go ahead. I understand you were close to Holger."
"I was," she said. Then she fell silent. There was nervous muttering in the church. It was impossible to decipher her body language, although most thought she seemed angry or stunned. When finally she began to speak, she was barely audible, even to those in the first row.
"Louder!"
somebody shouted. She raised her eyes and looked lost.
"Holger was a pain," she said. "Tiresome. He wouldn't accept it if people didn't want to talk and preferred to be left alone. He didn't know when to give up. He just barged right in and got all sorts of disturbed freaks to open up. He was dumb enough to believe in people, even in me. And there weren't too many people who shared that opinion. He was a proud old fool who refused to accept help, however bad the pain. And he always did everything he could to unearth the truth, never for himself. So naturally," she closed her eyes, "there was every reason for them to murder him. They killed a defenseless old man in his bed. And that makes me mad. Really mad. Especially since Holger and I..."
She never finished the sentence. She stared blankly to one side. Then she straightened up and looked directly out at the congregation.
"The last time we saw each other, we talked about that statue over there," she said. "He wanted to know why I was so fascinated by it. I told him that I'd never seen it as a monument to a heroic deed, but rather as a representation of a terrible assault. He understood immediately and asked, 'What about the fire the dragon is breathing?' I said it was the same fire that burns inside everyone who is being trampled on. The same fire that can turn us into ashes and waste, but which sometimes, if some old fool like Holger spots us, plays chess with us and talks to us, and just takes an interest, can become something totally different. A force which allows us to strike back. Holger knew that you can still get back on your feet, even with a spear sticking through your body. And that's why he kept on nagging. And was such a pain," she said,
and then fell silent again. She turned and bowed to the coffin, her movements stiff and angular, and said,
"Thanks, and sorry."
She caught a look from Mikael Blomqvist, who smiled at her. She may have smiled back. It was hard to tell. The church erupted with murmuring and whispers, and the priest had difficulty restoring order, for the procession passed the coffin. Hardly anybody noticed Salander as she stole along the rows of benches and disappeared through the church door, into the square outside,
and the narrow lanes of Gamlastan. This is Simon Vance. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of The Girl Who Takes an Eye for an Eye by David Lagercrantz, translated from the Swedish by George Goulding. This program was produced by Aaron Blank. Translation copyright 2017 by George Goulding. Originally published in Sweden as Mannen som sökte sin skugga by Norstedts, Stockholm, in 2017. Copyright 2017 by Norstedts Agency. This translation is simultaneously published in hardcover in Great Britain by Maclehose Press, an imprint of Quercus Publishing Limited, London, in 2017, by agreement with Norstedts Agency. Published by arrangement with Quercus Publishing PLC, UK. Production copyright 2017, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.